Our show. We just have less than a minute to go. Tune in to our expanded daily 2-hour broadcast from Chicago, from the Democratic National Convention, inside and out, from the streets to the suites to the convention floor. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people: Mike Burke, Shrutha Gokuduse, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warner, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Anna Elias. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, and right here to CAN TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're in Chicago.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. KABU's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KABU comes from KABU members and the International Travel Group. KABU Community Radio and ITG are organizing a journey to Cuba, December 14th to the 21st. It is a guided exchange of music, history, and landscapes. ITG supports KABU's mission of fostering community through diverse voices. More information at kabu.fm/Cuba.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Support for the KABU Evening News comes from KABU members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland City Commissioner and mayoral hopeful Renee Gonzalez is investigated by the Elections Office. Pride organizers in Malala cancel their event after online threats. And in national news, the Democratic National Convention kicks off this week. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, August 19th, 2024. I'm Nathan Vandiver. The Portland Elections Office investigates City Commissioner and mayoral candidate Renee Gonzalez for potentially misusing taxpayer funds. The Portland Mercury confirmed that the Elections Office, which is under the Auditor's Office, is investigating an instance earlier this month. The Oregonian revealed that Gonzalez had spent $6,400 on cleaning up his Wikipedia page. The money reportedly went toward a company that trained his staff on how to request edits on Wikipedia. The question at hand is whether these taxpayer funds were used for personal and political benefit during the campaign season. Gonzalez's office has denied this, saying maintaining his public profile is something they would normally do. The auditor's office got at least three complaints, which were then referred over to the elections office. The most recent one alleges that spending this money was a violation of city campaign finance rules, which ban candidates from accepting more than $579 from a donor or from entities other than individuals or political committees. It's unclear which city fund the money for the Wikipedia edits came out of. This is the second time Gonzalez has been investigated by the elections office. In his 2022 campaign, he was fined $77,000 for accepting office space at a steep discount from local millionaire Jordan Schnitzer. The office found that was an unreported campaign donation. The fine was later dismissed by a judge. A Pride celebration in Malala was canceled this weekend after online threats. Hendy Appleton has organized a carnival and picnic for 3 years running in the town south of Oregon City. This year's entertainment included a drag queen story hour. This upset some residents who claimed they would show up to protest. Appleton, the organizer, wasn't as bothered by these remarks, but it was when the event news spread beyond her town that she decided to cancel the event. Clackamas County Proud Boys said they would attend, and that prompted Appleton to move to cancel and reschedule the event. She worried the out-of-town contingent could overwhelm the festival, which normally attracts about 150 people. Police say they were aware of the threats and were preparing to have extra patrols for the event. Appleton said, quote, "This is supposed to be a family event, coming in with the intent to disrupt, coming in with the intent to be angry, coming in with the intent to be violent is the exact opposite of what this event was intended to be." Appleton says the Pride event will return next year for sure, and she is considering hosting this year's event later in the fall on private property. One in four people over 50 are taking care of at least one person with a health issue or disability, according to a new poll. Jared Calfee with AARP Virginia says these numbers are growing as people are living longer and nursing homes are struggling with understaffing.
I don't know how much capacity there is to add additional burden onto these folks' plates, and that's the direction we're heading in. And so both at the state and the federal level, we are going to have to start to figure out ways to do more for these folks.
He says the average caregiver pays about $7,000 a year out of pocket. Many older caregivers are adding that on top of other jobs or kids. State and federal lawmakers have proposed bills to help find solutions. Those include tax credits for caregivers, reducing red tape around Medicare and Social Security, and lowering health care expenses. Public opinion on who should cover the cost of caring for older people is mixed. 45% of those over 50 think it should be the government. 27% said it should be the person receiving the care, and 18% said family or friends. Calfee says no matter what, caregiving should be a top-of-mind issue.
You know, think about the people in your family that you may someday have to care for. Think about the people in your family that may someday have to care for you as you age. And understand that these issues are so important and impact so many people, and very few of us are not going to be impacted by them at some point.
The U.S. Census Bureau says in a couple of decades, older Americans will outnumber children for the first time in history. Federal law enforcement officials say violent crime is down in the United States. That's despite public perception. And a new national report says there's been major progress in the U.S. in reducing youth incarceration rates, but troubling disparities remain. The Sentencing Project is out with findings that show between 2000 and 2022, there was a 75% decline in youth incarceration around the country. That coincides with a drop in arrest rates among minors. The project's Joseph Rovner says it's worth noting that youths of color are still more likely than white teens to be held in juvenile facilities.
This is one of the most daunting problems, that youth of color are treated more harshly at every point of contact with the justice system. They are more likely to be arrested. And after they've been arrested, they are less likely to be referred to diversionary programs.
Nationally, indigenous youths were nearly 3.5 times more likely than whites to be detained. Rovner feels that over-policing is a factor, and limiting law enforcement interactions for non-serious offenses can help reduce disparities. Rovner says one way to do that is by overhauling how police officers are placed in the school setting. As for the long-term progress overall, Rovner hopes the public takes notice of what the data show.
I think that the reason that this report has resonance is that it's surprising to many people in a country that believes that things are always getting worse, that believes that this generation of kids is worse than any generation that came before it, when the evidence doesn't back that up.
Rovner suggests that policymakers not lose sight of how successful diversionary programs have been, and that proactive states can serve as a model for others to follow suit. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555 across the Portland metro area have voted to authorize an unfair labor practice strike at Fred Meyer stores. Union organizers called for a strike in response to multiple unfair labor practices they say Fred Meyer and Kroger have committed. They haven't elected a date for the strike, but if and when that is scheduled, it would see 4,500 Fred Meyer workers on the picket line. Last week, UFCW 555 announced they would pull their support for the controversial Kroger-Albertsons merger. The merger is the subject of a federal lawsuit, which argues that combining the grocery chains would create an illegal monopoly and harm shoppers. Dan Clay is the local president. He said, quote, "While our local was the only local to publicly support the merger of Kroger and Albertsons, we have changed our position as a result of new information as part of the bargaining process. Kroger's continued failure to not live up to their commitments in current contracts while being given every opportunity is disappointing. Negotiations between the union and Fred Meyer are scheduled to continue this evening." The Democratic National Convention in Chicago is underway with heightened security following FBI warnings about potential threats. Protesters go ahead with planned demonstrations while the ACLU monitors the police response. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Let me be absolutely clear. The city of Chicago is ready to host the 2024 Democratic National Convention.
The head of Chicago's city administration, John Roberson, says the city is prepared to host the DNC. The FBI and Homeland Security have released an updated threat bulletin citing the chance of what it calls follow-on or retaliatory violence after last month's attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump. Security measures include everything from additional fencing around the United Center to a task force watching food preparation. Some pro-Palestinian protesters reportedly considered giving Vice President Harris a chance to break with President Joe Biden's Middle East policies. But many, like Lee Cass Stevens with Massachusetts Peace Action, say they see the convention as a moment to increase pressure over the war in Gaza.
This is a great opportunity to shines more light on the situation and pressure the Harris campaign to commit to an arms embargo and ceasefire immediately.
It's been more than 50 years since anti-Vietnam War protests, and a violent police response famously disrupted the 68th Democratic Convention in Chicago. Paraphrasing the chant from the time, some have said the party can't afford a repeat because the whole world is watching. And Ed Yanka with the ACLU says law enforcement can't get in the way of free speech this time.
People are going to come, they're going to be loud, they're going to be protesting. The question isn't whether or not they're loud, it's the question is how the police respond to that.
But Chicago Police Chief Larry Snelling emphasizes the city has made significant progress since then.
There was a Democratic convention between 1968 and now. It was a success. Chicago Police Department does a great job of working through events like this, and this will be no different.
The Democratic nominees headed to the city after a campaign swing through Pennsylvania. Ahead of Harris's acceptance speech, the convention will hear from former President Barack Obama and former President Bill Clinton. Monday night will feature former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and what's being described as a hero's send-off for Biden. Meanwhile, Trump is taking his usual aggressive tone on social media. Sunday, he shared a video of former Assistant Attorney General Andy McCarthy, who made a legal argument in favor of a Trump motion to have his hush money sentencing delayed again.
The Supreme Court's made clear if there's an open immunity issue, that needs to be litigated before anything else happens. And there's no good law enforcement reason why this sentencing has to take place prior to the election.
Opposing presidential campaigns generally choose to lay low during conventions, the logic being it makes no sense to try to compete with such a huge event. But Trump says they won't be doing that. In contradiction to what some allies are urging, Trump continues to mix insults and personal attacks on Harris into his speeches and promises what he describes as aggressive counter-programming to the convention. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with organizers from Bayan, Oregon about their push to end U.S. military aid to the Philippines. Then we'll speak with Paula Hood from the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project about their work on the forest plan revision process. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 78. Today in history, in 2017, tens of thousands of non-native farmed Atlantic salmon are accidentally released into the wild in Washington waters in the Cypress Island Atlantic Salmon Pen Break. A year later, the state Senate passed a law banning the farming of Atlantic salmon in the state by 2025. The quote of the day is from American poet Ogden Nash, born this day in 1902. He wrote, quote, "A door is what a dog is perpetually on the wrong side of." The Democratic National Convention kicks off this week, and Vice President Kamala Harris will need to court the native vote in a number of swing states that have tight races. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Democratic National Convention kicks off this week in Chicago. Vice President Kamala Harris is expected to receive her party's nomination for presidential candidate to run against former President, Republican Donald Trump. Courting the Native American vote is seen as vital of tight contests in key battleground states with sizable Indian populations. Last week at a rally in Glendale, Arizona, Harris said this.
And as president, I will tell you, I will always honor tribal sovereignty and respect tribal self-determination.
Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Nevada have high numbers of Native Americans and are all considered battleground states this year. Former President Trump has also courted the Native vote, including at an October 2020 stop in North Carolina.
Why I'm here, Native American. That's why we're here. The last administration promised to bring hope and change to Indian country, but they cruelly abandoned you the moment they got your vote, and they went to Washington. That's what they do.
Trump lost his re-election bid, with many Native Americans criticizing his ending of an annual White House Tribal Nations Conference started by President Obama and the curtailing of environmental regulations while president. And his running mate, J.D. Vance, has fired up controversy over past remarks on Two-Spirits and Indigenous Peoples Day. Issues being raised by Native Americans this campaign season include water rights, education, health care, and leniency for Leonard Peltier, among others. Stay tuned to National Native News this week as longtime anchor Antonia Gonzalez reports from the DNC. Voters across a rural Northern California county will decide whether to change the name of a town that honors a 19th century settler who had enslaved and murdered Pomo and Wapo peoples. Jacob Resnick reports.
The town of Kelseyville was named for Andrew Kelsey, who in the 1840s raped, tortured, and murdered indigenous peoples forced to work on his cattle ranch near Clear Lake, about 85 miles northeast of San Francisco. He and his business partner were killed in an 1849 uprising led by the Pomo and Wapo peoples he had enslaved. The following year, a bloody reprisal by the U.S. cavalry killed hundreds of Pomo, mostly women, old men, and children, in a dark chapter known as the Bloody Island Massacre. For decades, the name Kelseyville has been controversial, as it honors a man who had committed crimes against Pomo and Wapo peoples, and a citizens' movement has in recent years pushed to change the town's name to Canoctai after a 4,300-foot volcano that towers over the town. Opponents to the name change had urged the county supervisors to limit an advisory vote to those who live in the immediate community, but Lake County supervisors voted 3-2 last month to make the vote countywide. Supervisor Moak Simon, who is also tribal chairman of the nearby Middletown Rancheria of Pomo Indians, said it will be a referendum on how far Lake County has evolved in its understanding of history that predates European settlement.
I want it on record where this county stands with the indigenous people that lived here and have been here before it was created.
The non-binding vote will appear on the November 5th ballot, but the ultimate authority to change the community of Kelseyville's name to Canocti lies with the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Northern California.
And I'm Brian Bull, hosting from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
An annual report on pollution violations at Idaho's wastewater treatment plants finds little change between 2022 and 2023. As Eric Tegedoff reports, more than half of the state's plants reported violations.
A new report finds pollution violations at wastewater treatment plants have been a problem in more than half of Idaho's communities. The Idaho Conservation League's annual study of the state's sewage treatment plants says 58% violated Clean Water Act standards during 2023. Will Tiedemann with the Idaho Conservation League says his organization didn't find much change between 2022 and 2023.
It's kind of the status quo has continued from last year. There are still a significant number of facilities across Idaho who violate. And of that, you know, it's usually 10, 11, 12 facilities who make up the lion's share of that.
Tiedemann says his organization continues to study not just violations, but loads over limits, or the severity of the violation. Three facilities in Driggs, Parma, and Preston accounted for about a third of total violations. On the positive side, 47 cities and towns did not report any violations in 2023. Tiedemann says violations typically occur because of elevated levels of phosphorus or nitrogen from an excess of nutrients. He notes that excess nutrients can create problems for water bodies, such as algae blooms.
There are real-world consequences for the environment and for recreation and for human health.
Tiedemann says violations occur more often in smaller communities, and there's a reason for that.
Large cities in Idaho have a tax base to where they can have more advanced treatment systems. They have more things to treat, but they kind of have an outsized availability of resources to address that. But lots of smaller towns in Idaho don't always. They have limited budgets.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
California is considering a bill that would collect data on reports of discrimination in healthcare. This follows years of anecdotal evidence that women of color tend to receive inadequate treatment. Suzanne Potter has the details.
A bill headed to the state Senate floor this week would require California to start tracking discrimination in healthcare. Assembly Bill 3161 asks the State Department of Public Health to collect self-reported patient demographics from complaints at hospitals and long-term care facilities. Shalita Smith from Corona says she feels bias played a role in her treatment when she faced a life-threatening hemorrhage after childbirth at an Orange County hospital in 2007.
The emergency room doctor, he basically told the nurse, "We need her out of here. I want to discharge her." So she came in the room with the discharge papers, and she said, "I'm scared for you." And I said, "No, I'm scared for myself." Luckily, I was able to stay, and if I would have went home, I would have bled to death. I wouldn't be here today.
The bill would also require hospital patient safety plans to specify methods to address racism and discrimination in healthcare, including procedures for staff to anonymously report instances of racial bias. Raina Granberry with the California Black Women's Health Project says she's heard of cases where patients felt that staff ignored them or discounted their level of pain.
Hearing a father come in and say, "We've asked the doctors for 7 hours to intervene and she laid there for 7 hours and bled to death." It is a pain that ripples through the community. It's crippling to our collective well-being to continue to experience these types of things.
Hospitals maintain that they offer the same high level of care for all patients, regardless of race. Anyema Obikea with the Black Women for Wellness Action Project says the data, when broken down by race, will tell a different story.
It's really important for patient safety plans to actually consider the role that some of our biases play in the quality of care that patients receive, particularly when they are people of color.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The population of beluga whales in Alaska's Cook Inlet has been in decline for decades and is now on the federal endangered species list. The group Defenders of Wildlife says water and noise pollution, along with a dwindling supply of food, are taking a toll on the whales. Mark Richardson has more.
Beluga whales are known as the canaries of the sea for their melodious songs, but conservation groups are concerned that one pod in Alaska could be rendered silent. Belugas have lived in the Cook Inlet near Anchorage for centuries, but because of a deteriorating environment, are now on the federal endangered species list. Reagan Davey with the group Defenders of Wildlife in Alaska says the population of the extremely social and vocal Cook Inlet belugas have alarmingly decreased by about 80% since the 1970s.
They stay in Cook Inlet all year round and they live under the ice for parts of it. There's so many different threats that are affecting them. There's three main ones are noise pollution, water pollution, and prey availability.
Davey says the beluga whales are experiencing a variety of threats that don't endanger other whale populations in Alaskan waters. She says their territory in the Cook Inlet is right outside one of the most developed areas of the state. While orcas and polar bears are the beluga's natural predators, Davey says water pollution and a diminishing salmon population account for much of their decline. And although by law they're no longer hunted by humans, the trappings of modern-day civilization also weigh on their survival.
When feeding, belugas use echolocation to find food. Parts of their habitat are in a lot of the most developed parts of the state in Cook Inlet. So commercial ships and machinery noise can really impact the whales when they're trying to find food and talk with each other.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Alaska Beluga Monitoring Program trains volunteer citizen observers to monitor the whales at points along the inlet and report their findings. Davey says the extra eyes are needed to count them and keep tabs on the species' progress.
I really encourage Alaska residents to sign up to volunteer for the monitoring program. The more people that understand what this population is enduring, the more people that are able to join in on the recovery.
The Beluga Monitoring Program is online at akbmp.org. For Alaska News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 19th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Zachary Jones, New Ray. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Mark Richardson, Farah Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, and Brian Bull. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nathan Vandiver. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon activists have been keeping the pressure on Senator Jeff Merkley on the issue of U.S. military aid to the Philippines. Activists confronted Merkley at multiple town halls this month, pushing him to introduce the Philippine Human Rights Act, which would create limits on U.S. financial aid to the Philippine police and military until human rights violations end. KBOO's Zachary Jones-Naray spoke with Carolyn and Junix, two organizers from Bayan, Oregon, to learn more about their organization and the international movement they're a part of.
For those of us who are listening who might not know what BIAN is. Can you guys maybe give us an explanation or some background on the history on a national and then statewide level, if that sounds good to you?
So BIAN Oregon is an alliance of progressive grassroots Filipino organizations representing migrant workers, women, youth, and students. We are a part of the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines, organizing and mobilizing the 99% of the Filipino masses with workers at the core.
And then, hi, this is Junix. I'll just add on that BIAN advocates for the rights and welfare of our Kababayan here and in the Philippines. Our alliance also wages campaigns that assert our right to health, housing, and education over the U.S. Marcos Jr. regime's prioritization of war and profit.
So on the national level, so BIAN Oregon is our regional alliance formation, but we are a part of BIAN USA, which does similar work, but on the national level. So really serving as a campaign center for, you know, campaigns that are being waged from Seattle to New York to Florida. And our movement as a whole, like the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines and our alliance is BIAN USA, we're an extension of BIAN Philippines. So BIAN is an alliance that also exists back in our homeland, again, serving as that alliance of progressive grassroots orgs that represents a variety of classes and sectors of people.
Yeah, which I can imagine must be a difficult conversation at times with the BIAN in the Philippines. I mean, maybe that's just my own assumption, but with the current conditions that we're talking about and that you, we're trying to raise awareness towards, that I can imagine that could be difficult. Is there any thoughts on that own relationship out of curiosity from both communities across, you know, this distance?
Yeah, I would actually say, you know, we as an extension of BIAN Philippines are in step, you know, with the fight for national liberation back home. We as, you know, Filipino, both Junix and I, you know, Filipino Americans who were born here in the States, we do really see, you know, the root problems as the same, right? When we think